Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses for an audience of real entrepreneurs. I don't think you can tell, but this side of my face right here, my forehead is suntanned, and this side is not. It's so weird. Natalie, I was running 20 miles yesterday, 21 miles. I earned that last mile. And I, for some reason, didn't put any sunscreen on, and I'm just running in the heat. I guess I didn't expect it to be so hot in January here in San Francisco. And I can feel that this side of my body is getting a tan. And I finally went into a sports basement, and I say, I'm going to get a drink, and I'm going to find a way to get some sunscreen without having to buy a $10 sunscreen. Someone will have it, something. They had a tester.
I was going to say a sample, right? A tester?
They did. It was like a kid's sunscreen, and I just went and put it all over my face without even looking because I was too freaking tired. It was 10 miles by then. And then I start running outside thinking, wow, this smells really nice. And it wasn't until I was done with my run that I realized, wait, the whole way out, you've got sunscreen on. So this side of your head on is like the way out, you don't have sunscreen. This side of your head is getting sunburned. This side is not because of the way back, you've got sunscreen. Who cares? It's worth it. It's worth it. I will suffer for that.
21 miles is legit. It is worth a little bit of sunburn.
It was so painful, dude. It was so, my legs were hurting. My enthusiasm for running towards the end was gone, but I'm trying to run a marathon on every continent. So I got to push myself. And then I thought to myself, not only am I running marathons on every continent, at the end of it, I got to do an interview. Can you imagine?
I cannot imagine running 21 miles, let alone an interview after that. I don't know.
In person, live with someone in like Mexico and Chile, where they're going to be speaking Spanish more than English. But then again, I'm here with you, Natalie, the next day doing an interview. So this is good practice.
This is good.
All right, yes. Let's talk about what this interview is about.
All right.
Natalie Nagel, which rhymes with bagel, is back. Well, her husband was on here 8 years ago, Natalie, nine almost, to talk about this little company called WildBit. At the time, they were like the little company that could. And I remember Chris was on here and he revealed his revenue and I could see his heart pounding because he revealed it. You don't even believe that he revealed his revenue.
I really don't believe that he did it. I have to go back and listen.
I'll tell you why. You guys at the time had just launched Postmark, but it was doing well. It was doing, from what I remember, over $1 million in sales. And he said, look, all these freaking guys are now coming into this space getting tons of money and funding, and I'm going to compete against them. And when I talk to clients, they have to know we are not just some like bootstrap wannabe operation. We're a bootstrap, profitable, revenue-generating operation. I won't tell you the exact numbers, but I'll tell you, Andrew, we're doing over $1 million in sales. And I was proud. He was proud. I feel like you guys don't celebrate enough. Like in that moment, he was both scared and proud that he did it. And years later, when people were asking me, why do entrepreneurs reveal their revenue? I said, there are lots of reasons. Here's why. Chris from WildBit came on and he revealed it because it gives people credibility. Anyway, Natalie is on for a different reason. I don't even know what the reason is because I asked her, what's your goal here? And she said, I don't know, whatever. We're just going to have fun. But I will tell you this. Here's my goal for Natalie. They had this little bootstrap operation, and still she goes and she gets a job, and she does it for less than a year, which nearly breaks up her relationship with Chris. And then she says, all right, I'm going all in on this. And she is running this company, WildBit, which does more than Postmark. They have built a collection of apps that help people build apps and run their teams when they're building software for the internet. And so Postmark is one of them. As you'll see, there are others. One of them, at least, they sold. We'll find out about the whole thing. Thanks to two phenomenal sponsors who make this interview happen. The first will help you hire developers. It is called TopTal. Oh, and they are the best of the best developers. And the second will help you host your website, right? It's called HostGator. Natalie, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Natalie, revenue now. It's 9 years almost later. How much are you guys up to?
More than a million.
I asked you, can you give me some number, give me a sense of scale? And you said, how many users, how many paid users do you have?
We've got over 20,000 paid users.
Across how many different apps?
Two.
Two?
Two. We
sold one. I thought it was three.
Well, the third one hasn't launched yet. So the third one has beta users.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's
two. And the third one, the fourth one we sold, right? So we used to have, they move around.
Let's talk about what they are. I'm just going to do it quickly. Postmark for delivering transactional email, things like, hey, your account's been started, use this link to reset your password, that type of thing.
Yep.
There's Beanstalk, which I never freaking understood. The website says complete development workflow. I'm not a developer. How can you tell someone like me? How would you explain to a seven-year-old what Beanstalk is?
I mean, we launched Beanstalk before GitHub. So it's basically, it's version control hosting. It's Git hosting, but what we did was we did deployments and workflow and all that kind of stuff early on.
At a time when people said, why would I put my software in your hands? Why would I put my code in your hands, right?
That's the story, yeah. Chris went to friends and said, would you do this? Because he was managing our subversion servers at the time and said, like, would you let me host it? And they're like, what are you, nuts? It's like, I'd never give you my source code. And, you know, he's stubborn, thankfully. And so he's like, we're going to do it anyway. And I mean, we launched that thing was like, it's 11 years old. So that's
like the granddaddy of them all, the thing that started everything. Yeah. And then there's, by the way, I'm looking over your shoulder. It looks like you're like in a 12-year-old's room, in a 12-year-old's bedroom. Where are you? This is your office?
That's my office.
In your house?
No, at the office. We have a Philly office, but it's got to stay clean. Otherwise, my head gets foggy.
I'm like that too. If my office is messy, I just can't think clearly. The problem is people send me stuff. And if it's something that they sent me, like I got these two beautiful games that somebody sent me, really expensive digital games. Yeah. Taking up freaking space, it clutters my mind, but I can't bring myself to throw it out or sell it or anything. I keep thinking, I'm going to use it sometime. What's your big distraction in the office that you can't get rid of?
There's a box that I'm staring at right now on the floor that has... So our office has always been like a collection of things that from my house. It's very personal. Like, and we kind of filled it that way. And there's inside this box is a cast iron pot that my mom brought from Russia. That we brought to the office at some point, I guess for cooking or something. And I have to bring it home, but I don't want to bring it home because I don't know how to do it at home, but I don't really want it in my office. So it's just tucked into the corner of my couch. And I just stare at it every once in a while and I don't know what to do with it.
You know what? That came from Russia. You know, let's get into your story. I'll quickly tell people the other app is Conveyor, or workflow you use, not manage. And then the company that they sold is DeployBot, lets you deploy code anywhere. Natalie, you're from Russia. You guys are what? How'd you guys end up in the US, your family?
We came in 89 as Jewish refugees.
What does that mean?
So we left St. Petersburg. In Russia, there's kind of two nationalities. You're either a Russian or a Jew. They used to say Jew in passports and stuff like that. I don't know if it's...
Wait, in passports, they would say Jewish?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm Jewish and there's a lot of... There's discrimination, but also just even... It's not officially discriminated, but there's discrimination. And there's also this inability to succeed if you're Jewish. So my grandfather is an engineer and an inventor, and he would create all these inventions, and the patents would have his boss's names on them because you can't have a Jew on the patent. So in when things were kind of crumbling in Russia in, you know, 88, 89, 90, Israel with the United States kind of did this thing where they're like, we'll take all the Jews out. And Russia was like, fine, take them. But it was this mass migration. And so what happened was you kind of left in a hurry, but you didn't get anywhere in a hurry. So what we would do is we actually lived in kind of encampments in different countries. So we lived in Vienna, Austria, and in Ladispol, Italy for about 4 months, where you kind of left and then you couldn't really get to the US because they couldn't absorb everybody fast enough. So like through various like nonprofit organizations through Israel, they created these support, you know, areas where they paid for housing and you lived like two or three families in an apartment and you kind of did your thing waiting for your opportunity. And it was a combination of, we had family in Philly, so like they had to pay some amount. I forget, my mom said there was like some amount and they had to collect the money and it was maybe $1,500, but we kind of waited for them to collect the money and file the paperwork and then you came over. So we did that in 1989 and came here with basically nothing. And, you know, what I try to tell my kids all the time is, you know, when I say nothing, I mean like all of our furniture came from the trash. Like my dad and my grandfather at night would like leave the apartment and go pick through people's trash, which is really funny because I was with my daughter the other day and she saw a couch out on the sidewalk and she's 9 and she goes, you would have been really lucky if you were little and you lived here. And I couldn't figure out what she was talking about. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, that's a really nice couch across the street. You could have had a really nice couch. And I was like... Okay.
Wow.
But yeah, so we did. It's the, you know, your very typical American dream. My dad was a doctor in Russia. My mom was a classical pianist, a choir conductor. Came here. They cleaned houses. And then they both got what I say is like the job that was the fastest way to financial freedom, right? So like my mom became an ultrasound tech because that was an 8 month or something like that, you know, training quick, pays really well. My dad became a tech for, you know, heart stuff. Like, you know, just whatever was like the easiest way to like support a family, build a life, build the, you know, American dream.
And then they did. And meanwhile, Chris, before you'd met him, started WildBit. He was 20 years old. And WildBit at the time was what?
We did client services work. So if you, 18 years ago, it was Flash. Lots of nightclub websites, lots of bubbles and floating things. And
I remember I called him out on that. He said that he did some restaurant work. And I said, at the time, their restaurant's still using Flash. Are you doing it? And he said, I'm telling you, I tell restaurants to stop using this freaking Flash. But if they insist, they're my clients, I'll do it and I'll set
you
it up.
You do have to do. But yeah, I mean, that's what he started doing very early on and remote first. So like he had met a guy in Romania and on a user group who's young and basically needed to start building websites. And he learned very quickly he was not a good software developer. So that was like, you know, a very early on
Chris
understanding. What were you saying?
Chris is not a good software developer?
No, he doesn't code. He doesn't write a line of code.
What's his title?
CTO.
Yeah. Okay.
He's extremely technical. I mean, he runs all the infrastructure stuff. And we've both been doing this for so long. People get shocked that I can manage engineers. And I was like, I cannot write a line of code, but you do this off long enough with smart people who have taught me so much that like I can manage it with like the rest, you know, as
like
good
what?
As
give
the
me one tip as a non-engineer who has to manage a lot of engineers and build software for engineers. What's one tip you could give us other non-engineers?
On leading a team of engineers?
Yeah. Guiding somebody when you don't know how to do what you're guiding them to do. What's one tip?
So I think for me, I still ask a lot of questions and I ask them to like explain to me how, to me, engineering is less about lines of like the code, but how it's architected, right? That's how you have to understand the success. So I just, architecture, I can understand, right? To explain to me why this service talks to this service and figures out this service and why we're stuck, you know? And so just a lot of questions and that's how I learned how to speak the language.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things I have to keep telling our pre-interviewers. Ask the guests questions. Don't, if they just throw out some random term, don't pretend you know it and don't feel like an idiot for asking. You should be asking that. You should say, hey, explain what that means.
I ask all the time. I'm like, I don't know what that means. And they'll look at me and I'll be like, yeah, explain it to me. But you kind of have to explain it to me because you want me to be on your side, right? You want me to understand what's going on. So tell me what's going on.
Don't you feel like, hey, how are these people going to take me seriously if I have to ask them basic questions that they probably are going home and laughing at me for not knowing?
I mean, I don't know. Probably before I would be, like when I was younger maybe, but now I know that there's a million things that I know that they don't understand, a million things that I mean, I'm constantly trying to learn and I don't actually ever think of it that way. I think more that it would be stupid for me to have a conversation with somebody and pretend that I know something and then walk myself into something where I show that I don't, right? So like that's a much worse scenario to be in. So I'm honest, like that's not something I understand. I've gone to conferences. I mean, I've been going to conferences for so long where, you know, I used to go, I'm the only woman, right? Or I'm like, everybody just assumes I'm, you know, oh, are you with the spouses? You know, go over this way, you know, or that kind of thing. And, you know, I'll have conversations with other software engineers and they'll talk over me or, you know, just assume. And I'll just be honest. I'll be like, I don't, explain that to me. Like, I don't owe you anything, right? So I just kind of look at it and say, I want to understand what you're talking about. You want to have a conversation with me. I need to be on the same page. So tell me what this big data, not out of whatever the hell they're talking about, throwing some terms out that I don't care about.
And you know what? Here's the thing. A lot of times when you ask them, they don't know what the hell they're talking about either. And then that kind of brings them back to reality. Stop pretending, stop posturing, just be here and explain this to me.
They don't understand how to explain it. So, I mean, like a smart person can explain something really complicated in simple terms, right? So a lot of times I'll ask, I'll keep asking. And it actually helps people understand that they don't actually realize what they're talking about.
Let's continue then with the story. You and Chris met, you started dating, you would help him out at his company from time to time at WildBit. Meanwhile, as I said earlier, you went and took a job in risk management. Why would you do that? Forget about like why you wouldn't work at WildBit. I just mean like, what is it about risk management that excited you? Be honest with me. I shouldn't have had that attitude. Let me step back and say, hey, what is it about risk management that's so interesting?
Your first attitude was right on point. While it was very young at the time, Chris and I were living together. We had gotten married my senior year of college, and we were investing all of our money back into the business. And I had taken the degree at Temple because I'm only now realizing I have certain passions or things that I'm really excited about. But back then, it wasn't like I had some tremendous energy around anything, honestly, anything. It was like I wanted to contribute to the world and have a great job and do something really meaningful. And so at Temple, their risk management department was like it's like one of the top of the country and pays really well. And I was like, well, listen, then that's what I'm going to do. It's hard and we're going to do that. And so that's how I got into it. But the key was that, you know, as you go through the degree, you get an internship, you do that. You got an internship and they were like, we love you. We want to pay you $48,000 a year start. I'm 22 years old, $10,000 sign-on bonus and a 10% annual bonus and health insurance. And we were just got married. And so I was like, well, I'll go do that. I mean, I went to school for it. They love me. I have an opportunity to build something. And we'll live off of that. So what was so beautiful about that was we basically, like, all of my income went to our checking account and everything the business made went back right into the business, you know? And it was a beautiful thing. It was actually, from that perspective, it was great.
You were just like, you were floating the relationship, buying the groceries, that type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We lived, paid our mortgage, because we had a house and, you know, just anything we went out, vacations, whatever we wanted to do, that came out of that. And every penny out of the business stayed in that, like a totally separate bank account.
I got to tell you, Natalie, my wife now has been working for big companies here in San Francisco for a few years. It is really nice to have a big company insurance plan. Up until then, I'd always paid for entrepreneur insurance, whatever it was that I would even do for my company. Even when we had 50 people and it was good, it was still not nearly as good as like when Olivia was at Yahoo and there was something she needed. And I said, how are you going to get it? We have an advocate who works with the insurance companies.
Yeah.
The hell? All right. Send it to the advocate. And then the advocate would go to bat for you.
I know.
It's just amazing to have that. And I get why you guys would be drawn to it. And then Chris's sister had an issue. What happened to her that got her in the hospital?
So I started work in July and September 10th, Chris's sister was pulling out of a parking lot and got hit by a drunk driver. And she lived in Denver at the time. She just started law school and she was in a coma. And she's fine now, thank God. But, you know, we were traveling a bunch to Denver when all of that happened. And, you know, I was taking a bunch of PTO days and it was weird, right? Like I had to like ask for it and it has to be like and everybody was very supportive. You know, it's not like that, but, you know, there was still like a process and I felt like I had to think like, oh, I got to go back to work and, you know, can I come back again? And, you know, what does that mean? And it was just like a very uncomfortable process. And at the same time, we were fighting the two of us more in those 9 months that we had fought in the 4.5 years we were together.
You know, let's get real here. What kind of fights? What were they about?
I grew up, Chris and I, my parents are entrepreneurs. Like, so if you think about like that whole story, like eventually my parents became entrepreneurs and both my parents have run big businesses. And so I was used to entrepreneurship. So when Chris and I were dating early on, you know, he missed my best friend's wedding because we had a work problem. And I was okay with that. Like you know, there was like this part of me that like you work, entrepreneurship is a 24-hour business. I don't care what anybody else says, but like you might not be sitting physically in front of the computer, but you think about it, you're thinking, you know, you're doing all these things. And so when I went to go work, I'm in this corporate job, you know, they love me, blah, blah, blah. There's a ladder to climb and I'm working hard. I hadn't gotten jaded yet where I realized corporate America, everybody works like 30% of their effort, right? And that's like considered amazing. And so I would work 60, 70 hours and Chris would be like, I can't believe you're not home. Like, what are you doing? Why aren't you home? Why aren't you, you know, like, why are you working so hard? And I was like, dude, you worked for 5 years, you know, like for 5 years I supported you in working all these crazy hours. And I think like over time, I mean, we don't fight in general. So like that was like a very unusual thing for us. And then it was like, you know, the PTO days and like, what are we doing with that? And I think culminated in this, why are you giving your efforts to somebody else when we have clearly the opportunity to do it all for ourselves? And it wasn't like you're working too hard. It's we were separated for the first time in our relationship. And it was like not, you know, it was weird. You know, like I'd come home and talk about my job and he'd want to talk about WildBit. And it was like, we're just not built that way. I don't know. We've been doing this together 15 years. We just celebrated 15 years. And like, we're just built a different way. And the two of us are built to do this together. You know, that's just how we are.
And he wanted more of your time because he had some before. And it's like, why are you giving it to these people instead of to us? Why don't you care enough about our relationship? That, all right, those are pretty good fights to have. Yeah. All right. So then you're going and you say, you know, I'm not sure what to do. You go to your parents who came from Russia, who used to go and take garbage into their house so that they could have furniture for the kids. And you say, I want to go work with Chris. And what do they say?
So my mom was like, I can't believe it took you this long. And she was like, I don't understand why you went to work in the first place. But my parents never said, my mom's good at like, I don't know why you did that in the first place. Like, why didn't you tell me 9 months ago not to do it in the first place? But that's a different story. But my mom was like, that's ridiculous. Like, of course you should do this. And then my father-in-law, Chris's dad, who's always been like a mentor and advisor in the company, he's run big orgs. He's never been an entrepreneur himself, but always run big orgs. And he was like, no, you shouldn't do this. Like health insurance and risk and all these things. So actually we had a really nice balance of very kind of a conservative approach. And then my mom was like, I've learned from her, you just run and you figure shit out as you go, you know, and you just run as fast as you can. So it was a really good balance. And I did it.
And you quit your job. You went to work at WildBit. This is before they had any software. Let me take a moment, talk about my first sponsor. Yes. Then we're going to get into that thing that you finally launched. Every development dev shop seems to want to create software. And I get why. Most don't end up doing it. You did. I want to find out why in a moment. But first, I've got to tell everyone, including you, Natalie, do you know about TopTal?
I have heard about TopTal, yes.
Man, they need to get the word out even more. So you say, of course I did. Here's how we work with TopTal. Here's the deal with TopTal. In fact, I'll tell you a quick story. I was talking to Nathan Lotka. He's not a developer just like you, but he said, you know, I want to buy this Chrome plugin. So he goes out and he buys a Chrome plugin that lets people send out email later, track open, that whole thing. He eventually called it the top email, but he buys it and he doesn't know how to code. He doesn't know what to do with the freaking thing. So he goes to TopTal and he says, I need to get a developer. TopTal gets him a developer. He says to the developer, look, everything's fine on this, the way it works. Here's what I need you to code. I want to start getting paid for this free plugin. Here's what I need. Whenever people send more than X number of emails using my Chrome plugin for Gmail, put up an alert that says pay to get access for more. And if they don't want to do that, give them like an X or something that says, I want to use this one more time for free. So they do it. And suddenly this thing that he's losing, not losing money, that was losing money before he bought it because they had to pay for developers, suddenly is making money because he paid a TopTal guy just to put up a pop-up after X number of uses to tell people to pay. And now he's got this business that has a revenue stream that he can use to build up the rest of his company. Now, why did he go to TopTal instead of somebody else? Why didn't he just look around for the cheapest person he could find? Because he wanted a really good developer, someone who wasn't going to screw things up, someone who's going to think creatively, someone who could take his mission and not say, how do I do this and how do I screw it up? Or how do I do this? And Nathan, you tell me every detail what needs to get done. No, with TopTal, they're the best of the best. You just tell them what needs to get done. They've seen these problems before and they want to solve good problems for you. Anyway, if you're out there and you're looking to hire developers, tons of places where you can go. If you want to hire the best of the best developers and get started with them fast, you'll be shocked by how fast you can find a phenomenal developer at TopTal. Go to top as in top of your head, tal as in talent. That's toptal.com/mixerg. When you go to that URL, I will get credit, which thank you for doing that. But more importantly, you're going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period. Really, no-risk trial period. So don't go to them when you want the cheapest. Don't go to them when you want to just spend time looking. But when you want the best of the best Google-level developers fast, you can often start with them within days. toptal.com/mixerg. All right. You guys decided, Natalie, you were going to create your own software. My guess is you said, I'm tired of us trading hours for money, building other people's software, building other people's company. I want to create our own thing. And then the first product you created was?
Actually, Newsberry, which was in 2004. And it was created, we were doing client work and we had a client who needed to send newsletters. And in 2004, there wasn't a lot of options. And so we were kind of like, oh, let's like build something. And Chris had the idea. He's like, well, what if we had our customers invest in it? And so we basically went to a few clients and said, hey, if we build this thing and you give us $2,000, I swear it was $2,000 each, you can use it for free for life. And so he collected, I think, like 10 grand and was able
Not invest in it as an own a piece of the business.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
That's brilliant.
I know. Yeah. I know.
So give us money. We'll create this for you. You'll have this software for life. And that's not
for life.
Okay. All right. And then what do you guys do with the money? That's really smart because that, I feel like, tell me if I'm wrong, Natalie. Keep interrupting me because I'm getting excited right now and I know I'm going to interrupt you. I feel like one of the best parts about this is now you have paying clients who depend on this being done. And now you can go back to your team and feel the same sense of urgency to finish that you do when you have client work instead of this is going to be back burner. Whenever we have spare time, we'll build it.
Yeah. So Chris's whole thing back then was we needed to be able to, I mean, in client services work, any week not working on clients is not, you're not billing, right? So we needed to have basically pay ourselves to write this thing. So it was enough money that we could pay ourselves to write this thing. And knowing that we had existing customers, A, and also a feedback loop, right? Like we had people who were actually sending newsletters. And so that's how we built it, built Newsberry, hired an engineer. And so we ran that thing, but always generated most of our revenue through client services, right? So through building websites. And that became this like back burner, but it was definitely our first foray in billing and running a SaaS business and all these things. And so that was kind of like the thing. And then we built Beanstalk, which is the only one. Obviously, Newsberry is not around anymore. We shut it down. Beanstalk.
Let's pause on that for a second. All right. You had your first clients. You got good feedback from them. I know it's been over a decade, so it's hard to even remember Is it hard to remember what feedback came in that was especially useful, or do you remember it?
In aggregate, I probably remember a bunch. I remember the stuff that I wish we had done that we were stubborn about not doing and that MailChimp ended up doing because they're smarter than us.
For example?
People really like templates.
And they kept asking you for templates.
Like pretty, you know, like a Halloween template and like a Valentine's. And I was like, what the hell is wrong with you people? Who wants to send a Halloween template, you know? And it was, we were just stubborn. Like we were stubborn about, we knew that rendering emails in the different browsers was a pain in the ass, right? The different clients. And so
every time somebody said, give me a theme, you said, wait a minute, do you understand if I give you a template, it's going to work great in Hotmail, but horrible in Gmail. Yes. And then when Hotmail changes tomorrow, it's going to stink for them too.
Exactly.
And so that's what you kept saying no to.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, they wanted to be able to copy and paste out of their Microsoft Word documents. You know, they would like draft emails and then wanting to copy and paste.
And you were against it.
Yeah. Cause we were like, this is not better. This is not good end result, right? You're not providing value. And we were right. But the point is we were stubborn and not solving the problem. We were just like, you're wrong, which is dumb. Right. And I could tell you years of examples of, we did the same thing in Beanstalk. I mean, we've grown a little bit from that, but we used to be so dogmatic about you're just wrong. And that, I think part of that is, you know, when you leave client work, you're kind of, because a client says, make it round, you're going to make it round, right? Like you can bang your head against, one of my favorite stories about client services work was an agency that we worked with. And they said, they went into a room with a huge customer and the customer's like, we like everything about this, but could you make it round? And they all look like, what do you want us to make round? Well, just, you know, I want it to be round. They're like, the computer screen or the browser? Like, what do you want?
Right.
Right. But so we got into our own products and it was like, well, I get to say no. And no, goddammit, you are not getting a Halloween template. You know, it was stuff like that. It was definitely the big one that we really screwed up was people really wanted individualized data on one subscriber. And we looked at email marketing as an aggregate, right? Like you want to know how your list is doing, not how Andrew is doing, you know, with your list.
Right.
And I remember this to this day, like some of the companies that invested in us originally, they wanted that. And we just couldn't, we were so thick headed. We were like, that just doesn't make sense. Like, I'm not building this for you. It doesn't make sense. And, you know, I think ultimately it comes down to, we weren't sending our own newsletters. We had no idea. You know, we were barely, you know.
Right. When you send your own newsletter, you feel it more. You guys were not in that world. But then what you're saying is, your big takeaway was, if they were asking for something like templates, and you saw the problem in sending out templates the way that they were asking for, your job should have been to say, why do they need templates?
Exactly.
How do I give it to them in a way that doesn't break the software?
Which seems so obvious now, but you have to think, like, this was 10 years ago, no, 2004, 14 years ago, and we were not very smart.
Okay.
They were just young, you know, like,
but you know what else also? I feel like this is before lean startup, before customer development focus. It's something else. It is at a time when we were thinking you need to be opinionated about software. This is roughly around the time when the guys from 37 Signals had the same thought, which was
they were a huge inspiration. I mean, we followed them along. I mean, that was it. It was. Like,
I feel like they have a blind spot to this stuff. They really believe that you have to be an artist to understand what people are looking for. And in many ways, they were right. They were competing against Microsoft, which anytime somebody would ask for something, they would throw another checkbox into their project management software and let people turn it on when they wanted it or off when they didn't. And they created this bloated project management software that you could only figure out if you understood what every checkbox meant. And so 37 Signals came out with Basecamp and said, we're going to make the decisions for you. And that was helpful in competing against Microsoft. But I do wonder if they could be listening to their customers much, much better and developing more for them. Still, as a Basecamp user, I'm kind of happy with their software.
I credit them so much because they took a person like Chris and gave him a vision to say, I can, like, if you told Chris he had to build a business today that involved people and selling and marketing and all this, talking to customers. I mean, that was the whole promise. The promised land was we were going to build these apps. We wouldn't have to talk to customers. Money would just come in. We would build the things that we wanted to, right? And if you build it, they will come. And, you know, all these things. I mean, like, that's what I still hang out with a lot of folks who built businesses back then, right, who have big, successful apps. And there was this feeling of, you know, you have introverted folks who are just kind of like, I want to build something really cool, make some great money doing it, and this is it, right? We used to tell, like, regular people, well, who are your customers? Like, I have no idea. They sign up, they pay every month. We never talk to them. We never hear from them. I don't know. You know, and it's just not true like that anymore, right? You realize that it's
that
just-
That was the dream always, too, that you build a website and then people self-serve and so on. Okay, yeah. And so because of that, you guys eventually did what with Newsberry?
So we shut it down. So Beanstalk, we built Beanstalk in 2007, 2008, and really took off. And so we made a commitment at the time that we were going to stop doing client work, but not fire anybody. So we had to wait till Beanstalk made enough money with Newsberry to kind of cover all the expenses. And so we got to a point where Beanstalk was running the show. It was basically paying for everything. And Newsberry is actually making money, but it was a humongous distraction. Like, we were not dog fooding it. We didn't understand the market. We didn't understand marketers. And we kind of had to make this call. So actually, when I left my job, I had come on and my official role was to revive Newsberry. It was going to be to give it one last life, see if I can, like, make it a thing. And it was like a stepchild of the family. You know, like, nobody wanted to hang out with, sorry, that's a bad reference, right? I didn't mean that. Like, you know, the,
I get the that proverbial old phrase, stepchild. Yes, not the rethought it. But I get what you're saying. Look, this thing is not doing well. You've got clients who are paying. And then about 3 years later, you guys say, we're going to create our next piece of software, Beanstalk. And that came from where? What was the issue that led you guys to come up with that?
Just managing our own version control. Like, you know,
you explain that to non-developers.
Yeah. So if you think, the best way I've explained it forever has been, you know, Microsoft Word has something called track changes, right? Mm-hmm. It's the ability for multiple people to edit and collaborate on a document. Well, software developers need the same thing. They need one, they need an ability to track the history of their work, but two, be able to collaborate on that work, on that code together. So you have something called version control, which is just an open source platform. It can be whatever it wants to be. Right now, it happens to be Git for most of the world. And you can track your changes, you can work collaboratively together, but it's a server, right? It sits, like, it has to run somewhere. So what we built at the time was one of the first hosted ways to hold your source code and build a face on it. So instead of going into the server and adding a user and running all these commands, like, you had a UI and you could, like, add a user and comment on your code and do all this stuff. So that's basically what we built. We took something that was, and this has been, like, our trajectory, I think, a while, but it's like, take something that sucks in the development process and try to put a face on it, try to take some of that pain away and let us absorb the pain through UI and or through infrastructure or whatever, that we can manage it and then clean it up for end users. So that's kind of what it was.
Did you do any checking to see if other people wanted it? Did you pre-sell this one?
No. We had a beta. So we had, like, asked, you know, we basically went out to friends and said, would you use this? And they were like, no, you're crazy. And so we built it anyway. And then back then, there wasn't a lot of apps launching. So when you launch something like this, this was pretty cool. Like, we did an integration with Basecamp and 37 Signals, like, blogged about, like, a dedicated blog post about it, you know? And so this was a time when you could gain a lot of traction. So we launched a beta, a free beta, and let people play with it. And then kind of got it to a place where we were comfortable. And then my favorite story of, I think, the 18 years was Chris and I sitting in our apartment and we launched paid plans. And we did some napkin math and we're like, well, if 10% of customers, you know, upgrade, then that'll be great. And so we like launch it, send the email, and we're sitting there and we go and refresh the billing page and nobody's upgraded. And 2 minutes later, refresh it again. And then we're ping the developer. Is it working? He's like, let me check. Yeah, it's working. And we're like, why is nobody buying? As if people were just sitting there waiting for the opportunity to pay for the thing. We were so silly. But yeah, and that we launched it that way. And we had the beta users to sustain us for a little bit. And, you know, I don't remember what the percentage was, but of course they eventually bought, you know, once they checked their email and upgraded and put their credit card in. And then we kind of rolled it out from there.
What was the integration with Basecamp?
It was all project management. So it was like the idea, like if you had a project, you could link the commit in the so when you commit a line of code, you could commit it. We would send a webhook up to Basecamp and it would show up in the project and it would kind of integrate back. We had a ton of integrations. That's actually how we grew early on, was all integrations. It was, you know, how can you build this one piece of your process with all your other pieces of your process? You would integrate, they would share, you would share, you know, it became like a very symbiotic, it used to be a very symbiotic relationship that way.
I'm trying to pull up that blog post, but it's not coming up. Oh, what? There it is. Beanstalk is a hosted Subversion system, making it easy for anyone to set up, browse, track, and manage Subversion. This is the way they blogged at the time. Wow. I guess that's what it is. Oh, no. This is somebody else blogging. No, this is them.
Is it them?
This is them. Wow. That was not like the most interesting blog post that they ever did, but I guess what they're doing is they're saying, look, we have this software. Other people are integrating with it. You should sign up for it too.
Andrew, that brought in a tremendous amount of customers. Wow. For years.
Actually, it's two sentences. I'm now seeing it in Internet Archive from something called 37signals.blogs.com. I guess that's where they were blogging for a bit. Yeah. Wow. All right. I'm going to talk about my second sponsor. Second sponsor is a company called HostGator. Every time I do an interview here, I feel like there's somebody who signed up for HostGator as like their first website. I asked you if you did, and what you said, I don't even know. Why would you say you don't know?
Because any first website would have been hosted by Chris. I have no idea. I have no idea. But I definitely remember seeing HostGator bills when I used to do QuickBooks for the team. And we paid for something. I just couldn't tell you what.
I'm telling you, these guys have been around forever. Let me tell you how I'm using HostGator right now. First of all, I have one of those plans. And if you go beyond that initial plan to the one that costs like 20, I don't know how many cents. Let me look exactly. Since I'm doing a sponsorship, I should actually know this. HostGator.com/MixerD. While I look up the price. Oh, there we go. If you go for the Hatchling plan, it's like what? $2.64 a month. If you upgrade to the baby plan, $3.98 a month, you get unlimited domain hosting. So let me give you an example of what I do with it. I told you I'm running in the streets of San Francisco. Well, it's prepare to run a marathon on every continent. Well, the thing that I did was, and this came to me from a breakfast that I had with a friend. He said, give it a website. So, oh yeah, once you give it a site, it feels like a thing. Now people can go back and reference it. It feels like something more exciting. So I did that. And I'm glad that I did. It's called runwithandrew.com so people can follow along with my progress. I busted my freaking foot like weeks, days into my training, and I couldn't walk on it. I was starting to limp and things were just really painful. I thought this whole thing's going to be over. I get Devin, who's Devin Meadows. He's right here in the office, who's shooting video. I said, Devin, I've got to go to the doctor and look at this. He goes, we don't yet have a lens. Like, we're starting out to shoot video of my journey. We didn't even have a freaking lens because Amazon took forever to ship it over here. Because do you want to wait a day? I like the way you're thinking. Let's you know what? If we're going to shoot video, let's prioritize that. So we wait a day. We go into the doctor's office completely unannounced because the doctor has weeks of waiting. And I say, I need your help. I can't step on this foot. What do I do? And the doctor now knows about my journey. Everyone in the doctor's office knows about my journey because they're all like seeing the website because they Googled me when I said this is what I was going to do. And so they say, yeah, come on in here. And they help me out and they give me some medication. And I was off my foot for a little over a week, taking up to 6 pills a day, steroids, I guess, and then gradually reducing it to 1. And my foot was fine. And the moral of the story is if I didn't have a website, it was just like some random thing that you're doing. It's like, sure. Everyone has a goal for this year. Congratulations on your January wish list. But no, now they see the website. It feels more real. So let me tell you this, guys. Seth Godin does this really well. Anytime you have an idea that like, you want people to rally around, you could create a blog post, you can go on to Medium and announce it, you can go to your Facebook page and say it. Nobody's going to take it seriously. You give it a website, for some reason people take it seriously. analogy that I give is like the old A-Team. Do you ever see that, Natalie? TV show?
A-Team?
A-Team.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. A lot of people didn't. I feel like you must not have had cable growing up.
Probably not. I don't
know. My parents were so against television, even though they were addicted to television. They were like, if we don't get you cable and we don't give you options, you're not going to be able to watch TV. Meanwhile, they'd watch TV every night. It would just be crappy TV. Anyway, in the A-Team, Face, I don't even know the guy's name, but he was Face. He would pretend to be a lot of different people. And the way that he would get people to believe him is he'd just hand a business card. And as soon as people would see a business card, all right, he must be John whatever, because he's got a business card. Same thing with website. If you need a website for any idea that you've got, go to hostgator.com/mixerd. Again, you'll be giving me credit, but also you'll get a super low price, up to 62% off their already low prices, and they'll host your website right, give you unmetered disk space, unlimited email addresses, 24-hour tech support, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, 45-day money-back guarantee. So if I'm full of it, do it. And guys, let me tell you something about it. Forget about their money-back guarantee. I stand behind this. We are living in a world where every podcaster is playing music behind their ads to like distance themselves from the freaking message. I listen to The Verge podcast, Natalie. I love Nilay Patel, but he will not talk about a sponsor without A, having changed like sound effects in the background. Like, we're getting paid for this. And number one. And number two, he reads it super fast. Like, I got to get this over with fast because I can't believe I'm doing this as a journalist. No, I believe I'm doing this. If I don't love them, if they don't treat you guys right, I don't want to have them as sponsors. So I stand behind them. Go to hostgator.com/mixerd. Natalie, you finally had these customers coming in. Let's talk a little bit about marketing. What did you do to actually get Beanstalk to grow? Wait, no, not Beanstalk. We're still on the on Beanstalk.
Yeah, we're on Beanstalk.
Beanstalk was the first one. Okay. What did you do to get people to use it?
Very much subscribe to the if you build it, they will come. And so it was all word of mouth for us. I mean, we did the integrations, but we just focused all of our efforts on building a really spectacular product. And now
let's not get past the fact that integrations are really big. They still are to this day, and they were big at the time, right? Every time you integrate, the company that you're integrating with has an excuse to tell its audience to blog about you, to list you on their website, right?
I think the power that it had back then, I think, is lost. I mean, at this point, it's, you know, you have Zapier and you have all these amazing things that you can kind of do stuff yourself. I don't know, to be quite honest with you, I don't know. I think some of that stuff is starting to, you know, people have like heads of partnerships and doing all these things, and it's turning into like a monetization thing. Back then, it was genuine, and it was like, how do we make our product better? And, oh, it'd be really cool if it worked with this. And the folks on the other side, like the Basecamp, you know, were like, oh, this is cool. Like somebody else, you know, you can use Basecamp, and then look, it can even tie into your version control. Now you have like the whole flow. And so, you're probably right, but I don't know that I could say that it was as powerful. It drove, I mean, there's old interviews with us from back in the day that were literally like the only way to grow a product is through integrations. And like, I could never say that now. You know, like
I do feel like it helped at the time. And I've talked to several entrepreneurs who did that and worked, and you're right. It's definitely not as powerful today, but I don't want to just walk away with just improve the product and customers are going to come, because that's not the way the world works. So what did you do? So talk more specifically about how you got customers, how you got users.
No, I swear to you, that's all we did. And that's why it plateaued. And that's why we're building a new product.
Is that right? That's as far as you got it.
Yeah, I mean, we got it. It's a big product. It's not like it's small, but we hit, we did not get it to where it needed to go. I mean, I think you have to, like Chris and I, marketing is one, not part of our DNA. And two, it's also something that for a very long time we believed was like an evil. You know, like it was not the way it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
It was like, this was not what we did. This is not why we built a business. We did not want to do these things. And so it took us really hitting some really shitty points in our lives to realize that like
what? What's a shitty point?
Well, so I guess, so we hit this plateau. Beanstalk, basically growth went like, Chris got really, you know, he had been running the business for 10 years. You know, we'd been together for, I guess, 8 at that point, and he was really unhappy and didn't want to come to work. And so he took a month off, went to go hike Bhutan with his dad. I met him in Bali with a kid. Well, we had one kid and I was pregnant with the other one. And, you know, we were in a dark place. Like I had, you know, I had panic attacks. I didn't even know what the hell that was before. And I'm like washing dishes and realize I can't breathe. And I think what we uncovered in that process was, up until that point, we had no idea. we really thought it all was given to us. Like, we were not in control of anything that had happened. So, like, I could not have told you a single way to fix it because I don't know how we got there in the first place. So we grew this big business. We were, you know, a big profitable team. Chris and I are making a ton of money. Like, the team's doing really well. Everything's great. And if it goes down, I don't know how to get out of it because I don't even know how we got here. You know, like, what am I going to do? Build more features? I know that's not going to work, right? Like,
wait, you were making money. Why not just get comfortable at that point and ignore everything? I feel like that's not a shitty situation.
Because if you're not fixed a plateau, it's not gonna stay there for very long.
Yeah, but most people don't realize that until it's not staying there for very long. What was it that just kicked you in the butt? Was it him feeling disconnected from work and starting to feel a little
depressed? We eyes pretty wide open. I mean, I think like we were there for a little bit. It's not like it was month one, you know, like it was a couple months in and we were kind of like, all right, this isn't good. And all these great competitors are coming out and the features are better. And we hit a point personally, but also like the team, it was like, we really enjoy building things people love. And we got to a point where it's like, there's better products out there. Mm. Like, what are we going to do? Just keep building features? That's not fun. You know, it like culminated like, and Postmark was this, you know, like we had Postmark at the time and it was doing its thing. And, you know, there was this point where you realize the depressing part was when you realize you have no control. Because I hired a $30,000 consultant to come in and like help me do pricing. So I was like, that's going to do it. Everybody says go to 30-day trials and it works for everybody. So we spent all this money and effort and of course it didn't work. And so I'm like knob turning like an idiot and realizing that, you know, we're not solving the core of it, like what actually broke, which was we did not pay attention to our customers. We did not pay attention to the market. We did not pay attention to the need to get out there. We did not understand why we were running the damn business in the first place. I mean, we had to do a ton of soul searching to just understand why. Like, we have a very specific charter to not grow too fast. So we are intentionally holding the reins back.
Because of this period in your life.
Yeah, I think because we understand. We spent a lot of time understanding why, and we realized like why we want to run a business, and we want to run a business I look at a business as like it lives in service of the people, not the people in service of the business. Like that's a really important thing for me. And to me, like a business is this insatiable beast that you constantly have to feed, right? That's its nature, bigger, 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 fatter, you know. And so if you let that take control, then there's no stopping you. And all the friends that I have who have let it take control and exited in some way or form are not happy, right? It's rare you see a happy exit when it's not
really.
Well, when you're in control, it's very different. But a lot of times those things, like, they run, right? These businesses grow. You get into these conversations. Oh, my God, we're going to do this thing. It's so big. It's so big. And then all of a sudden you're like, shit, what did I do? You know, like, why am I here? And so I think what we wanted to do is when we realized that, like, we need to harness it, right? We need to understand why. The answer was, like, I want to be super profitable. Like super profitable because that money goes directly to my family and to our ability to support our team. So it was a priority number one. To move faster would mean less profits. And I don't want to play that game. So it's like for us that understanding. And then it was like, okay, well if we're in control now, let's figure out like how we're going to get out of this. You know, and it was like, what do we know?
Like what? So it's interesting that you pitched us to be here. I think Chris is someone I pitched back then. So this means that you really embraced marketing because this is like the most spend the most time. Andrew has a process and then I've got to conform to his process and his team. So you definitely come around to some kind of marketing and getting out there.
Well, and we realized why. And so I'll tell you why I pitched you, why my team pitched you and why I've been doing these is it has nothing to do with the products. I've learned over the last 5 years that what I'm crazy obsessed with is to prove that a company can exist in service of the people and that everything that we can do is maximize what we give back to the people surrounding us. So that's like our customers, our team, obviously, first and foremost, Chris and myself.
So wait, here's what Christina told us when she pitched you. She said, one way that Natalie got through this was by asking, what do I need instead of what does the business need?
Yeah.
Okay. And so when you say, what do I need? I get you want it to be very profitable because that goes to your family and it also allows you to keep paying keep paying your people who then can take that money home to their family. What else do you need that helped your business grow?
That helps
schedule
my business.
Schedule works for you. What else do you need? More fun at the beach?
No. I need to be able to prove that we can do this for something bigger than money. So
what's
I think
the bigger thing?
I'm very convinced that with intentional thinking, a business can run in a way that enables people to have a better life outside of work. So like we do a 32-hour work week, right? We've been practicing this for over a year and a half. Not because we want to like be stupid, but because we're trying to say or trying to prove to ourselves first and foremost that we can create an environment that's growing, but that's only that only exists for the team, right?
So, wait, like, so you're saying we have to the thing that got you back on track was saying I can prove these ideas work. The idea of
I can prove hours. No. I mean, the 32 hours is a new thing. What proved was we went to why, right? And what was the why? And the why is like, we want to build a business to be independent and to be able to do whatever we want and to support this incredible team that has supported us over the years, right?
Okay.
So like we looked at that and said, okay, what does that mean? That means values. That means culture. That means building a business that's profitable so that we have money to spend on people, building a business that's peaceful, that doesn't have terrible sales practices that we're embarrassed of, that doesn't build a product that sucks because it'll make us more money. You know, it was like all these things, like what the question starts and ends with, is this in the best interest of the people, not the business? And I think that is a tremendous change, because what was happening when you hit that plateau is you start moving knobs and you're like, feet. I'm like, well, I got to grow faster. What is faster? How fast? What does that even mean? And who says that that's what I need to do?
Okay. Now, so once you figured out your thing,
right?
What did you do that allowed the company to stop plateauing and start growing?
Well, for a second, we took some deep breaths. I mean, just the clarity of mind was really, really, really important.
Because before you talked to our producer, my producer said, look, at one point she heard 30-day trial. So she did a 30-day trial. Then she heard that you have to raise prices. So she raised prices. Yeah. Then she heard it was content. So she started doing content. It's like all this stuff just drives you nuts because you're testing different things, not giving any one of them a chance to breathe. And they don't work.
Well, because they don't, because we all run software businesses. We have different markets, right? And our market. And so like, you can't, what works for you doesn't work for me. And then there's all these other things. What do I feel good about? What do I not feel good about? Content could work for me. I could be writing 3 pieces of content a week, but am I going to wake up in the morning and be like, yay, 17 ways to better transactional email? Like, no, you know, like, I don't want to do that. So it was clarity of mind was first and foremost. And then it was just intentional planning. So like we started looking and saying, all right, what does the business look like? We decided to focus on a new product instead of Beanstalk. And we started building this thing called Conveyor. And, you know, that was for the team. It was like, well, we don't want to just keep launching features for Beanstalk. That's not fun. And then we looked at Postmark and said, this is our most viable prospect right now. And Chris and I just doubled down and we hired an incredible team. We ran super lean. Last year is the first year, 2018 is the first year where we are almost not profitable, like barely black in 18 years of running this. 2018. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Even though part of your come to Jesus moment was we have to earn a profit.
Yeah. But we knew how, we had to figure out how to get there. Right. And so sometimes in businesses, you realize that you got to do some investing. And so we did a bunch of that. We realized that a lot of the stuff that we've been dogmatic about, like, we don't want to hire a lot of people. We don't want a big team. We want all this stuff. Well, it's like, well, you kind of need good people to do good things. So you can't do it all yourselves. We spent a ton of time understanding what our roles were, which seems silly, but Chris and I never, you know what it, honestly, and I keep coming back to this because I think this is really important. We are not good business people. We are entrepreneurs. And I think there's such a huge distinction. And what we learned is that we have to be better business people. And I still don't think we're good business people, but we're getting better. And I think having more of that mindset is helpful, because as an entrepreneur in my head, it's like you just chase stuff, you know, and you chase the stuff that makes you, and that's okay, that's good. But you also have to balance some of that, like, basic.
So what you did was you started sitting down and planning. Here's another thing that I highlighted. I was sitting with your notes all Sunday, just like going over it, getting ready. I'm training my kids, 2-year-old and 4-year-old, to just play on their own Saturday morning or Sunday morning. And almost always I will read a book or do something meaningful to myself. But today I knew I had a lot of work to do. So I sat down. I said, I'm going to get into Natalie's world for a bit. And one of the things that I saw was you said to our producer, look, we didn't have a 1-year plan. We didn't know what levers to pull. And so I wrote a note to myself to make sure to ask you, when you figured out the levers to pull, once you said, I'm sitting down, I'm going to have a 1-year plan. So 2018 wasn't just figure out whatever comes up, whatever blog post we read that excites us, we're going to go and follow their advice. It was sit and plan it out. What were the levers that finally worked for you? What were the things that when you were sitting and actually becoming an entrepreneur / manager that you did better?
We, the very first thing that we did for Postmark was sat down together and said, like, why do people love Postmark? Like, what's actually interesting about the product and what's our value proposition truly? Because we're the smallest, again, every time we build a product, we're the smallest ones in the room. And so what made us unique? And we realized that it was, you know, our value prop was what we call TTI, time to inbox, because transactional email, actually, it's not about getting to the inbox. That's a given. We're always the best at getting into the inbox, but we realize we're the fastest at getting to the inbox, which is actually money saved for people. Because
how did you know that?
Actually, Ryan Delk told us that.
Ryan Delk is such a freaking brilliant guy. So underestimated, except by people who know him.
It was a random, we were just talking about something. He was talking about something that he was working on, and he made a comment about how we were talking about Postmark, and he made a comment about how he would pay anything in the world to get emails to the inbox faster. And like, we started talking about it, because what you don't realize, and this is a product pitch, but like, what you don't realize is, or if you take Minecraft, for example, every email that Minecraft sets is a license key. And that license key, so your 18-year-old or 14-year-old kid, right, makes this purchase, sends it, and flips to their Gmail inbox and looks for that email.
Yes.
And they refresh the page once, and they refresh the page twice,
right,
three times, and they're sending a support request. So when you have a little team like Minecraft who all of a sudden blows up, and they're like, oh my God, all these people are buying license keys and their emails are getting delayed. They're not even missing. They're just late. They're taking longer than a second. It actually costs money. Like, they were looking at it and saying, like, oh my God, I'm going to have to grow this huge support team to just manage this. Like, where is my license? Where's my password reset? Oh my God. Like, you're an e-commerce site and your password reset doesn't come in right away. You lost that sale.
Yeah. What about this? Yesterday I was trying it was for my son. I needed a game. It was like an 8-minute. If he was going to sit with the iPad, which he rarely does, he needs to be able to do something that's going to teach him something. So it was a game. I paid for it. I couldn't get the damn email password back so that I could log in.
Postmark.
I'm done. I'm canceling them. So the reason that you knew this was big, and I see it on your website, it says right now at the homepage, reaching the inbox is not enough. It used to be about reaching the inbox that I think that you guys used to talk about. Now it says reaching the inbox is not enough. Here is the speed to get into the inbox and how we compare to the average. Like Gmail, you can get in there in 2.81 seconds versus the average of 5.97. So you're saying talking to Ryan Delk taught you that.
Years ago.
And the reason you talked to Ryan Delk was you wanted to understand what made our product special, and he works for Omni, right? The storage company.
Yeah, but that was before. He was at,
Gumroad.
Gumroad, yeah.
I'm fascinated by this freaking guy. So he was working at Gumroad, and he...
We were at a conference together. We were sitting at dinner.
And when you're sitting at dinner, were you saying, I want to understand why people...
No.
It was random luck.
It was a random conversation. We were 3 miles from home, and it was like a freaking light bulb went off, and Chris and I walked all 3 miles home from this dinner, and we were like, holy shit, this is it. Like, we didn't know it. We knew what we were doing, right? We knew it, but like... Explain. So we doubled down. We said, this is it. This is, so we spent all this development time building a status page that gives you, we track our own deliverability, like our own time to inbox, and we push it and we share it. We share what's good. We share when it's not good. We're super transparent about it, blah, blah, blah. And you can literally see the graphs, like the trajectory, like Postmark growth kind of like this. And then all of a sudden it's like this.
All of a sudden it just takes off.
Up and to the right. Yeah. Because
what's the difference between hearing Ryan Delk tell you one thing that was really important and somebody else telling you content marketing works or this works? Why was that the new approach that was effective versus the old approach that was not?
I think what he gave us, I think what we needed to hear, what we needed to understand was, how do we position ourselves, right? And I think we're like, content, all that, it's band-aids to a bigger problem. And so what we needed was to really understand, like, what is it that we're going to explain to people? Why are people going to look at SendGrid and at Mandrill and Mailgun and all these things and compare it to us and say, like, I'm going to use Postmark? We're going to say all the same shit, you know, oh, we're fat, but we get you to the inbox. Oh, we're so great. Oh, we have great support. Oh, we're the best. It's like, but that's not, we're not going to sell it, right? They have so much more clout. They're so much bigger than us. Every one of your friends is using SendGrid. Why use Postmark? And so when we started looking, that light bulb went off, because we had these huge customers, right, who were paying, and we were also very expensive. We were always the most expensive provider. I think we still are to some degree. And we needed to understand how to communicate that in a way that felt like us, you know, like, and we've always tried to be like, you know, we're not going to save you time and money, right? Like, I need to make sure that the words we use are meaningful and impactful, and they sound like me standing in front of you. And something about the way he talked about his delivery issues at Gumroad, totally, like, we both just, like, it was it. And we walked home. We walked all those 3 miles home. And I just remember this because we walked the whole time. We were, like, talking about it and just trying to understand. And we're like, this is it. And then we came up with this term TTI and we wrote the status page and it was the biggest thing. And you can see, like, you know, even just like in social and in conversations, people are starting to talk and people started to say, like, when you care about your email, you go to Postmark. That became what you were saying, when you care about your talent, right? Top talent. When you care about your email, you choose Postmark, and that's what everybody does.
Fair to say that part of the reason you were more sensitized to it is because through this period where you're trying to figure out who you were and what you were about, you learned you needed to understand customer problems, customer issues, customer needs more. And this was why you paid attention to it, where you think 5 years before you would have noticed that Ryan just gave you gold advice.
Yeah, we might have totally missed it. I think we were hungry for it. You know, we were definitely ready and trying to understand how we were going to stand out. And that was the problem with Beanstalk was, you know, how do you, what, how would I answer what makes you better than GitHub? I couldn't answer that. I have no idea. Way,
you mentioned your competition, SendGrid. So of course I go to SendGrid's website and they do the opposite. It's send email newsletters with confidence. Send, and then it changes. Send password resets with confidence, that they are just confident that it will arrive. You figured out for you, it's get it there faster. And that's the difference. By the way, I sent Isaac a note after his company was acquired by Twilio. He sent a really nice response back. I'm wondering, why is Isaac out of SendGrid? Do you have any inside information? What's going on over there?
We're not talking about that.
I have a theory. I think that he was doing really well, and then adult management came in, and then he bested and he was done.
Isn't that the rule, though?
That is the rule. I wonder, though, if he's happy with that. I wonder if he's just like, you know what? I do things for 5 years.
I don't know him personally like that. I have no idea. I think, you know, we have always been transactional only, which was, again, a stubbornness that I think actually served us well. But, you know, one of the nice things about being WildBit is I don't have anybody to answer to, right?
I feel like one of the things that you have that's a challenge is you don't enjoy going out and talking to me and asking for speaking engagements and doing all that stuff. You don't enjoy it, do you?
Going out and asking for it?
Yes. Like you're not going to pitch conferences and say, we should be speaking because we're bootstrapped and we're going to be there. You're not doing that stuff.
No, you know what's terrible is I feel like I have to earn it. And if I ask for it, then I didn't earn it. And so then I just wait around until somebody asks.
Right. And who the hell knows? Like I'm not in your world. I would never think to ask you to do it. I'm going to speak at, you mentioned Bali. I'm going to fly to Bali to speak at this event for people who work their companies remotely.
Oh, I know that guy. He emails me. What's his name?
Martin. Liam Martin.
Yeah.
You're not going to be there. You're not pitching him.
No, I also can't. I have to be, listen, I have two little kids who I really like.
I have two little kids who I really like.
No, I know. So I have to be really, really conscious
of what you take, what you do.
Because Chris and I travel, the two of us together. We are very committed to spending our time together, the two of us.
That's a challenge that Olivia and I don't have, because she is working at that corporate job. She can't just tell. I pitch her on it. I said, Olivia, look, tell them you have to come with me to Running Remote, because you're going to, it's Running Remote, guys, runningremote.com if you want to hang out with me in Bali. I love that thing. I love the event. I'd rather they did it in San Francisco and I could hang out over here.
Yeah. But if it wasn't in Bali, Bali is far. It is, for me, it's like a whole day flight.
It is a whole day flight, and at least you can go with Chris. My wife is going to have to stay here with the kids while I go out, and I'm not even going to end it there. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to fly from there to Australia. I'm going to run a marathon in Australia.
Good.
Hell yeah. And I'm going to interview entrepreneurs in Australia, because it's such a pain in the butt to interview them here in the US. So I'm going to do
brilliant.
It.
Brilliant. That's a great idea.
It's my goal for 2019.
Sounds like a great business trip.
Right. All right. Here's what we learned. Here's what I learned that I love. Number one, if you don't really love your software, even if it's producing money and makes a killing someone else, you can't make it well for you. Like, you guys had MailChimp before MailChimp, or right around the time of MailChimp. Yeah, around the same time. You didn't love it. You don't really get excited about it. You got to move on. My dad had a similar situation. He worked, he had a store like in the hood on Myrtle Avenue in Brooklyn, which now is like a super nice place. People would come in there. guy was born in Iran. He barely speaks English, and people come in and they would talk like Ebonics was big at the time. And I don't know, what the hell are you guys talking about? How could you get excited about it? They would have these like rags that they would use to mop their heads in the summer. I forget what it was called. One of my guests here on Mixergy called it a church rag. That's not what it was for them. He wouldn't understand why they would want it, what they would want it. So he didn't go out of his way and say, how do I get these tiny little towels that people love and I don't even know where they're buying it? Because he didn't care for it. He eventually closed down the store. That's the move. I always said to myself, once you get to a place where you don't get your customers, just move on because it's going to fail anyway. So you were in a situation.
Right? I wish we knew that because I honestly, like today, if you told me go run an email marketing site, I'd talk to customers, go fly out, meet people, like ask questions. Back then we were like,
you'd love them? I think about Nathan Berry with ConvertKit. He loves his customers, but he's not dealing with like info marketer type. With marketers. He's dealing with creatives. Like he found a way to create the software for the people he loved.
Yeah. I mean, no, I don't know. But like I said, I still don't know what I love. Like I'm still back to like that 18-year-old girl who's like, what's your purpose here? And the only purpose I've been able to find. Yeah. I think it's people, right? Like I always tell people like my superpower is people. I love the team that I work with.
I see that. That's why I said go to the beach. It's not that I think that you guys like to go to the beach, but I'm doing research. I'm entering Natalie's world. I go to wildbit.com. I don't see a lot about what this freaking software is or the customers really. Yeah. What I see is meet the WildBit family. I see Chris's legs on the website and everyone else's legs because they're on the beach hanging out. We are WildBit.
There's a picture of me in the pool with a noodle.
Oh, I didn't even see that. A photo of everyone on the team. Yeah. And I guess that's what it is for you. Like you just love the team. You love the way that you guys operate. And that's the thing that gets you going.
That's my main product.
That's the main product.
That's what I believe. I think Chris and I the way I look at it is the products enable us. I mean, we are passionate about our customers and anybody you ask for, like we build great software and we adore them. And we're grateful to them for enabling this wild bit to exist and this wild where we get to experiment and we get to do whatever we want and all in the name of understanding how we can provide I want the team to, the wild bit exists to provide for a life outside of wild bit, right? That's the point. It's not.
So you know what? My friend Shane Mack, I invested in his company Assist. They create chatbots for enterprise clients. He said, we don't really care about the product. I go, what do you mean you don't care about the product? He goes, everyone else here, how am I going to compete with like people who are going to come work for me? How am I going to compete with the things that they could get from all these other Silicon Valley companies that are here that are going to go public any minute now? I can't compete with that. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to compete with them on salaries. I'm not going to compete with them on bonuses and or stock options or whatever it is. I'm going to compete with them by giving our people a really good life. And if I take care of my people and give them a good life, they're going to love their work so much that they're going to just keep working with our clients and they're going to love it. And sure enough, he's doing really well with it, which is why they had like a nice office environment early on where they had a mother's room, which fucking A. How many companies in San Francisco, when my wife was nursing, would send her to go and pump in like a janitor closet or in the bathroom?
I'll tell you a horrible story because when we built office, I had just given birth to our second daughter. And this is my office. This is how bad it is. And we finished the build out and I get here and I'm like, where am I going to pump? Because I have glass doors in every freaking office.
Right.
I didn't even think of it. Like these things are hard.
They are hard. And I don't blame people for not thinking of it. But I do think that when Shane said, this is what we're going to create for our people and that women are undervalued in San Francisco. So I'm going to make an effort to go after female engineers and female talent here. He put up a mother's room in his office and a seat for kids so that the kids can come and sit in the fucking office right there with their parents and create that kind of atmosphere. I didn't even think. I literally didn't know what a mother's room was, even though my wife pumped. I said to her, Olivia, he has something called a mother's room. She goes, yeah, of course. She understood it. All right. So I get it. I think what you're saying makes a ton of sense. I got to ask you one question. I always ask like this question that I think is stuck in my head and then, or not always, sometimes I don't. You came here, like the Jewish community in Russia suffered so much. You end up marrying a guy named Chris. Do your parents go, what the hell are you doing marrying Chris? Like Chris is like a Christian name, like the ultimate Christian name. No,
he is not Jewish. When we started dating, my grandmother came to me. We had been dating for a little bit. And she goes, puts me aside and goes, I just need you to know you can't marry him. I was like, Grandma, I'm 18 years old. Like I'm not marrying this guy. What do you mean? She's like, I know where this is going and you can't marry him. And I said, okay. And that was it. And then 2 years later, We are still together, and my grandmother's cooking him meals just for him because she adores him. And so it mattered. It mattered a lot. And I went one night, we're at my parents' house and we were talking about something, and Chris was like, I don't want to raise my kids Catholic. I want to raise them Jewish. I've always wanted to raise my kids Jewish because I
really said that.
Yeah. He said, I'm not really, really, you know, he's atheist. And he's like, but I've always loved the Jewish community. And I loved what that stood for. And all my friends who were Jewish. And I was like, yeah. He's like, yeah. So I was like, I'll be right back. And I just remember bolting across the house to my parents' house. I bolted to my parents' room. I was like, Chris wants to raise the kids Jewish. And my mom was like, huh? And I was like, I just want you to know that we're not getting married. Nothing's happening. But just in case, we're going to have Jewish babies. And she's like, okay. And I was like, okay, bye. And then we left. And that was the end of the conversation. We had a Jewish wedding. I mean, no, it matters. I don't know what would have happened. My sister married a really nice Jewish man. So thank God that we didn't have to go down that road again. You know, it matters. It matters a lot. The community matters. The traditions matter. So I'm grateful for that. And my in-laws are wonderful and have no problem. They celebrate all the Jewish holidays with us. So it's great.
Do you guys do Christmas? Do you have a Christmas tree in your house?
Do all of it. And we do New Year's. So Russian New Year's is a big holiday. It's like a 10-day bank holiday. There's a tree and presents.
I've learned about that. And it's not like they do a tree, but it's for New Year's, right?
Yeah, but it's got Christian roots. But in Russia, there was no Christianity for so long that, like, because there's Orthodox Christmas is in January. So New Year's is like basically an excuse to be drunk for 10 days. And I grew up with New Year's, but because we grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, my mom was like, we can't put a tree up before Christmas is over. So we can never have a real tree. So we had to go up on December 26th because, God forbid, the neighbors could see a Christmas tree in her window.
But you would do it afterwards.
So then when I started dating Chris, I started buying a real tree. And I was like, well, I don't have anything to worry about, Mom. And so my dad would come over and smell the tree. He's like, I love this tree. Because he's never had a tree. But yeah, you wake up at midnight, you open presents, you go to bed at 9 p.m. The kids go to bed. Everybody goes to bed at 9 p.m. You wake up at 11. Everybody comes over. You throw a massive party till 6 o'clock in the morning. Kids open presents at midnight and you exchange gifts, and it's a whole thing. So my kids do all of that. It's horrible. You should see my house. Oh,
I should be sending people to postmarkapp.com or something else. I'm actually going to recommend anyone who wants to get to know you guys, just go to WildBit. You're going to be blown away. The whole site is like tiny about the software and then a whole lot of photos of the people who work there, even the time in different parts of the world. Like right now, I can tell you in Philadelphia, it's 2:16 p.m. because they update their website for the time all over the world where their people work. They have their big, and this I really love, the rules for how we work. We've been going through our principles of how we work at Mixergy. I really like how you have it up on the homepage. Everything is really laid out, beautifully done. You guys have always had good design style. Go check them out at wildbit.com. And if you ever see Natalie at a conference, go, what the hell are you doing here? How did you even show up here? or maybe it's like not really Isaac. Not Isaac. It's not really Natalie. Just make sure that it's really her, not somebody pretending, because she's never there. She's just sitting and enjoying her family, enjoying her
I did a bunch of stuff last year. I enjoy it. I don't want to ask for it.
And if you're running a conference, ask for it. Like the people are running remote should do it. If you want to see me at a conference, I will be at a conference. Not a lot this year because I'm going to be running marathons all over the world. You can come and see me run marathons with me or just watch me do interviews. God, fantastic. Natalie, here's my thing that I've discovered. Me trying to find guests all over the world is good, but it's going to be a torturous experience because I'm going to get lost in like screening them and so on. I've discovered if I go into a city, there's like an investment group, a community I could partner up with, and they know who's the hot entrepreneur, what the hot business is. And so I'm going to do that, partner with them, do interviews all over the world, and bring people on Mixergy interviews with people outside of the U.S., want to meet me in person, lots of different ways to see it. You can go check me out at runwithandrew.com to see where I'm traveling or see me at this Ollie event in June, runningremote.com. I also want to thank my two sponsors who made this interview happen, hostgator.com/MixerD. Natalie apparently worked with them or just sent them money. Who knows why? From not really a business person. She might have just been sending her money for no reason.
Possible.
We all have that on our book. And if you want to hire a phenomenal developer, go to toptal.com/MixerD. Mixer D. Natalie, it's so good to have you on here.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. This is fun.
Cool. Thank you. Bye, everyone.